This Brooks, 12-1643. Ms. Prasad.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Vinayaka Prasad, and I'm counsel for defendant appellant Sean Brooks. Your Honors, this case is about ensuring sound prosecutions and sound law enforcement. I'd like to focus today on the remaining charges that have not been dealt with. The government has acknowledged one deficiency in the prosecution, acknowledging that Mr. Brooks was overcharged in counts 3 and 4, which constitute only a single offense, not two separate offenses as charged. The jury further rejected the evidence on count 2 of the indictment, and so we are left with count 1, which alleges that Mr. Brooks possessed a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense. Now, the government has further overstated its evidence on that count as well. Your Honors, the Supreme Court has recognized that suspects lie in police investigations for many reasons. We do not know all of the reasons. We cannot predict the reasons in every single case. But the Supreme Court has noted a number of possibilities. In Opper versus United States, it noted that it may be the zeal of the prosecution, the self-interest of an accomplice, the maliciousness of an enemy, or the aberration or weakness of the accused under the strain of suspicion that may tinge or warp the facts of a confession. In this case, we can see one potential reason that Mr. Brooks may not have been truthful with investigators. And that reason is that he was hoping to appear cooperative to ensure a better deal from the prosecution. He spoke with investigators before speaking with any attorney, and at the behest of those investigators who encouraged him to be cooperative with them so that they could speak with the prosecutor.
This is a great jury argument, but not such a great argument for the Court of Appeals. Arguing is that the confession was unbelievable and should not have been believed because he was giving the interrogating officer what he wanted to hear. That's what we hear from juries, arguments to juries all the time.
Well, Your Honor, actually the Supreme Court has specifically considered that. It has said that it is normally an issue for the jury to determine the credibility of the evidence that's put in front of it, but that judicial experience with false confessions actually allows us to take that question out of the realm of the jury. And we have a specific rule that addresses that, and that's the corroboration rule. And that requires that we don't simply rely on that evidence as competent evidence, but that we have to have some outside corroboration.
This isn't one of those cases where the conviction is based on the confession alone. There's a lot of corroborating evidence, most notably the discovery of the gun itself. I mean, we've got the physical evidence of the gun itself here, in his possession of it, and then the testimony from, is it his girlfriend? Using that term loosely?
Yes,
Your Honor.
Loosely, yes. The possession of the gun obviously establishes one of the two counts 3 and 4 that was charged. That was actually possessing a gun after having sustained a felony conviction or being a drug user. That does not establish count 1, which is that gun was possessed in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense. The drug trafficking offense, Your Honor, was never established by any other evidence. There was no evidence from his girlfriend, using that term, that he was involved in any drug trafficking offense. Her statements are limited to two potential circumstantial evidence of drug trafficking. One is that she drove him around on various occasions and he went into homes which she did not recognize.
Drug trafficking is pretty much the foundation of their whole relationship, which is why I was using the term girlfriend loosely. I mean, this was a dope dating relationship, and so when they were together, that's what they did, and they drove around to traffic in meth and...
Well, Your Honor, there is no evidence that he was trafficking in meth. The evidence that came from Ms. Hughes was that they used meth together and that they shared that with each other. She specifically stated that he never sold her any meth. And the other two witnesses who personally knew Mr. Brooks also specifically stated that they never bought any drugs from Mr. Brooks, nor did anyone ever testify to any knowledge of him selling any drugs, in any form of drug. In this case, there was a specific the specific statements that were relied on was that there was a half a pound of marijuana involved in a drug trade for these guns. However, there was simply no discussion by any party. There was no evidence at all that he had any relation to any marijuana in any form. The only evidence that circumstantially suggested that he was involved in a drug trade was that he was, both he and Ms. Hughes were found to be in a car that contained 25 ounces of cocaine. But again, that simply does not corroborate this discussion of a half a pound of marijuana being used to trade for a gun. There's simply no evidence of that. And further, the testimony of Ms. Hughes that they were driving around going to various houses simply establishes that they were driving around going to various houses. She specifically stated that she never saw any drugs during these drives, and she further went on to state that he may have had money during some of those occasions, but she doesn't know whether that was his money to begin with or if he received it from someone inside of a house. That's not evidence of drug trafficking, Your Honors. That's not corroboration. That's certainly not substantial corroboration of the essential facts that establish count one of the indictment, as is required by the corroboration rule. Very quickly, Your Honors, I see I'm in my rebuttal time, but I would like to point out that the government has suggested that this is a rule that no longer has any purpose. However, we can see the purpose in this very case. These are modern and relevant concerns, the way that individuals interact with investigators who are encouraging them to make statements. Those are the reasons that the Supreme Court has established this rule, and those reasons continue to be pertinent today. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Frossa? Ms. Cremins?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. Emily Cremins on behalf of the United States. Contrary to Brooks's argument, the government does not have to substantiate the elements of the charged offense through independent evidence. Rather, this Court's precedent and the Supreme Court precedent requires the government to present substantial independent evidence that tends to show the trustworthiness of the defendant's statement as a whole. Here, the government did that by corroborating key assertions in the defendant's statement. For example, the defendant admitted that he was a frequent user of drugs. He said he used cocaine at times or had tried cocaine in the past, that he smoked marijuana while in prison, and also that he used meth, I think, essentially whenever it was around, and that he had gotten into the dope game at some point in time. And the government corroborated that evidence by the testimony of Danielle Hughes, who testified that she had used meth with the defendant, through the testimony of Ben Rickard, who had also testified that he used meth with the defendant. They presented the testimony of Detective Adang, who said that they found cellophane baggies in the lockboxes, most importantly in the lockbox that the defendant himself admitted was his, and that those cellophane baggies are often associated with drug trafficking. Additionally, Trooper McNamara testified that his trained canine alerted to the presence of narcotics in both of the lockboxes. Additionally, Brooks admitted that he had been caught with 25 ounces of powder cocaine at one point in time. That admission was corroborated by Danielle's testimony that she also was in the vehicle when officers found those 25 ounces of cocaine. Additionally, the government corroborated Mr. Brooks's comments about the events of May 17th and 18th. They presented testimony that the officers knew that Brooks had a warrant for his arrest when they entered Danielle Hughes' apartment, that they confiscated lockboxes at that time, that Brooks gave them permission to or consent to search the one lockbox, and that they got a warrant for the other lockbox. And there is also sufficient corroboration that of the defendant's admissions that he possessed these guns. There was testimony that they found, as this court noted, the firearms in the lockboxes. There was testimony from both Danielle and her sister that they had seen pictures of Mr. Brooks with guns. Ashley, Danielle's sister, testified that she saw the defendant with the guns on the night of May 17th. Additionally, there was evidence that the corroborated the defendant's statement that he traded these guns for drugs. As I've already mentioned, there was evidence that the defendant had access to guns, and or access to drugs, and that he had been found with 25 ounces of cocaine. There was the evidence that he engaged in drug trafficking. While there was not a direct statement from Danielle that that is what he was doing, that is an inference that can be made from the fact that they were driving to houses that she was unfamiliar with, she was not allowed to go inside, that Mr. Brooks went into the homes for short periods of time, came back out, sometimes had money with him, and, as Danielle testified, that he kept a gun in the vehicle when they were making these trips. Additionally, the government corroborated Mr. Brooks' statement that he had what he referred to as crack sack baggies. That was corroborated by Detective Adang's testimony that they found the cellophane baggies in the lockbox that Mr. Brooks admitted possessing, and then also the lockbox that was the second lockbox that was found in Danielle Hughes' apartment. As this court noted, the jury was able to listen to the defendant's confession. In fact, they got the audio recording of that confession. It is in the record. I urge the court to listen to it. The district court listened and had no qualms finding that the corroboration that the government presented established the trustworthiness of Mr. Brooks' statement as a whole.
On the two 922G offenses, I know you've confessed error on that. I just have a question about that. We do have a split verdict on the first two counts in the case,
correct,
which is a little difficult to explain, since the two guns, the Tech 9 and the other one, 40 caliber handgun, were found in the same safe or the same lockbox,
mm-hmm,
the one that was searched second in time. And yet the jury found him guilty on one of those counts but not the other, and then found him guilty on the second two 922G counts based on the different status, felon in possession,
mm-hmm,
and the drug status. Were those two counts keyed onto either or both of the guns?
They were not. There was not a specific firearm identified in either of counts 3 and 4.
Okay.
They just alleged that from 2009 through May of 2010, the defendant possessed a firearm after having been convicted of a felony, and then also while being an illegal user of controlled substances.
And the jury wasn't then, therefore, instructed on which firearm pertained to?
I do not believe so. I can go back in the record and certainly look at the jury instructions to make sure, but I don't believe that there was ever a specific firearm connected with either count.
Okay. So the point is that those two convictions are not sustainable on the theory that there were two different guns possessed at two different times, acquired at two different times. It's not that,
correct,
kind of a case.
Correct.
Because nobody was very specific about that in terms of either how the case was charged or how the case was submitted to the jury.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
If the court has no further questions, I would just ask that this court affirm the conviction on count one, and then, as we stated in our brief, remand with instructions to the district court to merge the convictions on counts 3 and 4 and resentence. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes, Ms. Prasad.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, the government has again pointed the court to the same evidence that is outlined in the briefs, and I will not go through again the evidence that the defense points to, but I would simply point out that we need to ask if this is again an overstatement of the evidence. Is the evidence really that all of what Mr. Brooks was saying was substantially corroborated, or is it simply that the evidence that he knew at the time that he was giving his statement, that the investigators already knew about him, was he simply agreeing with everything that they were saying? Would it have been relevant to his cooperation with the investigation to deny facts that were in his criminal record, which he understood that the investigators already had? Would it be relevant to his willingness to cooperate to deny the terms of which he was arrested? Would it be relevant to his appearing cooperative that he suggests that he was not a drug user when it was clear from his prior criminal record, it was clear from the items in his locked box, that he was a drug user? None of those things would have helped him cooperate with the police. However, the one thing that substantiates count one is something that came from the police themselves. The police were the ones who suggested that this was a trade of drugs for this gun. And he didn't have to come up with a lie to cooperate with the police. He didn't have to come up with a story. All he had to do was say, yes, that's correct. What you are asking me is correct. I would ask the court to look closely at Danielle Hughes' testimony and, again, view whether or not there is anything in that testimony that really does establish his involvement in the drug trade. Is there anything in her testimony that actually undermines his testimony, which there is, in that she undermines the timing that he has given to the investigators, and she fails to corroborate his connections, which he described, in obtaining that that gun, which he links back to her. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I would ask that this court remand this case.
Thank you. You'll take the case under advisement, and I'll